what was called the back channel. In other words, it was a means by which the British government could communicate indirectly and covertly with the leadership of the IRA, which State Knife trod the narrowest of narrow lines, providing the IRA with intelligence on who the suspected British agents were, and providing his handlers, his British handlers, on who the IRA leaderships were.
I think so,
the key element in trying to determine, you know, what is a terrorist and what is a freedom fighter.
Peter, thank you very much for joining me. I appreciate you taking the time. Can you do me a favor? Can you tell us a bit about your newest book, Operation Chiffon, and maybe if you could provide a bit of a context as to like what was going on in Northern Ireland at the time of the operation that took place in your book.
Operation Chiffon is the fourth part of the history of Northern Ireland, of the so-called Troubles. The four books are, the original three were Provost, Loyalist and Brits, that looked at the three sides of the conflict through the eyes of the three main parties involved. Operation Chiffon really completes the trilogy and makes it a quartet. And really what it does is it traces the history of that critical almost three decades from the early 1970s right through to the Good Friday Agreement. There's a sort of arc. And that arc begins in the 1970s, which is when I first started covering Northern Ireland. Bloody Sunday was my introduction to it. And it was the bloodiest, most awful year of the Troubles. And it's really the story of how we got from there to Good Friday, from war to peace. And in particular, the role, which was unknown at the time and until relatively recently, unknown to the vast majority of the public, the role that the British intelligence services, MI5 and MI6, played in helping to convert that war into peace. And Operation Chiffon was the name of the final part of that arc. Operation Chiffon starts in 1981 and continues right through to effectively the Good Friday Agreement, because what Operation Chiffon was the MI5 secret operation designed to try and get the IRA to declare a ceasefire and enter political talks, which is what eventually happened. And so Operation Chiffon achieved its aim. I don't suggest for one moment that it was that delivered single-handedly the Good Friday Agreement. It wasn't. But what I'm saying is that without the IRA ceasefire, there would not have been and could not have been a Good Friday Agreement. And Operation Chiffon's role in that was critical. But Operation Chiffon was built on the previous two decades, the 70s and the 80s, in which an MI6 officer, Michael Oatley, which I'll talk more in a while, and the intermediary through to the IRA, Brendan Duddy, the Derry businessman, who was a completely unknown secretive figure, worked together to help move towards peace with varying degrees of success. So really, that's the arc of the book. Chiffon is not just about the operation called Chiffon, it's about the operations previously that Chiffon was built on. So basically, that's what the book's about. And also, it's about three or four remarkable individuals. Michael Oakley, the MI6 officer, who worked with Brendan Duddy through the 60s, through the 70s and 80s. Brendan Duddy himself, who worked throughout the whole period. And latterly, the MI5 officer, whom I got to know latterly as Robert, and it took me 30 years to find him and to actually get to interview him, who are three remarkably different individuals, all courageous, all dedicated by one aim, which is to try and find a way of getting the conflict to end and end the slaughter and the bloodshed. So that basically is what Operation Chiffon, the book, is about.
Thanks for the intro of the book. You said that the operation itself, Operation Chiffon, started in 81, but obviously built upon previous
91 it begins.
Oh, excuse me.
1991, yeah.
Oh, 91. Okay, very good. So like you said, it built upon the work of like previous intelligence missions and operations and so on. So can you give us a bit of an idea as to the, we'll say, like the ramping up of the involvement of British intelligence in the Troubles? Like, I assume that the very beginning of the 70s, when it was kind of kicking off, they didn't have anywhere near the level of involvement that came later. Can you talk to me a little bit about the kind of progression?
Yes, well, the involvement of initially MI6 were in the operations dealing with the IRA through the 70s and the 80s was not unlike the rise and evolution of Sinn Féin. In the 1970s, Sinn Féin really did not feature as a political party, as a serious player. It was there, but of little significance, apart from being the political wing of the provisional IRA. In the same way, when the Troubles began effectively in 1968 and then 69 with the deployment of the army, there was no intense involvement of any significance. Obviously, the intelligence agencies were keeping an eye on Northern Ireland because, you know, the trouble was brewing underneath the surface and then on top of the surface. It was only when it became really serious with internment in 1971, when hundreds of individuals were arrested and interned without charge. All those people arrested was the intelligence records were out of date. It was a disaster. That's followed by Bloody Sunday in 1972. And Bloody Sunday is followed by horrendous atrocities like the IRA's bomb attacks on Belfast, in Belfast on Bloody Friday, retaliation by loyalists. That's when it becomes really serious. And that's when Frank Steele, who was the first MI6 officer, to be involved practically in trying to, you know, come to grips with what was happening and what had to happen for it to end. When Frank Steele first became involved, Frank Steele, Michael Oakley had no knowledge of Ireland. They were sent over there on a sort of fact-finding mission to report back to the government on what the situation was. But they were largely ignorant of it, so they were learning very much on the job. And it was Frank Steele who said to Michael Oakley, when Oakley took over in 1973, when Frank Steele retired, it was Frank Steele who suggested to Michael Oakley, various people that he might find it interesting to get in touch with and talk to find out what was going on. One of those people was Brendan Duddy, and that's how the relationship between Michael Oakley and Brendan Duddy was established and how it evolved, because it was Duddy who lived in Derry, close by Martin McGuinness, not next door to, but a few minutes car drive away from Martin McGuinness. That's when they became involved. And because Duddy had the contacts with the then leadership of the IRA, who was then Rory O'Brody rather than Martin McGuinness and his later colleagues, that's how the contacts began. And the way they operated was via what was called the back channel. In other words, it was a means by which the British government could communicate indirectly and covertly with the leadership of the IRA, which in the early 1970s was represented by Rory O'Brody, who had been a former IRA chief of staff and was then the president of Sinn Féin. So it was Michael Oakley. This is the sort of first stage of a serious stage of the involvement, when Michael Oakley, having toured loyalist and Republican areas throughout Northern Ireland, but in particular in Belfast and Derry, just to find out, to get a feel, which is what I first did around the same time, because I was ignorant about Ireland and the Irish question and Northern Ireland. So Michael Oakley did what I did, which he travelled around the various communities, talking to the community leaders, just to get a sort of reading and understanding of what was going on, not just on top of the surface, but underneath the surface. So Oakley then devised a means of communicating with the IRA because you couldn't meet them face to face. And he developed what he called a pipe, which is a metaphorical imaginary pipe. And as he told me, if you blew down one end gently, Brendan Duddy, who'd be holding the metaphorical pipe in the middle, would pick up the sounds and then blow down gently again and communicate with Rory O'Brody and the IRA leadership at the other end. And that's how it all began. And that, in the end, in 1974, led to talks, face-to-face talks between the IRA leadership, represented by Billy McKee in particular, who'd just come off hunger strike in Crumlin Road Jail, hunger strike for what the IRA regarded as political status. And so a ceasefire did evolve, but that fell apart because loyalists who'd always, and loyalists and unionists who'd always feared that British policy really in the long term was to sell out Northern Ireland, pull the plug and to get out. That was always the loyalist and unionist atavistic fear. So the loyalist paramilitaries retaliated or responded to the IRA ceasefire, which they saw as the thin end of the wedge, by assassinating, murdering innocent Catholics and suspected IRA and Sinn Féin leaders. So in the end, the ceasefire falls apart, but it lastly was a means of communication that carries on right the way through to just before Good Friday. So that's how the involvement of MI6 begins. And then later on, when Michael Oakley retires, we're now moving swiftly on to 1991, after the hunger strikes, after another decade of dreadful bloodshed with Gibraltar, Enniskillen, a whole range of awful events. Word is now coming through from and the IRA that they're interested, this is all via the back channel, they're interested in considering a solution, ending the conflict, which of course is music to the Brits' ears. As a result of that, just before he retires, Michael Oakley meets Martin McGuinness face to face without any authority from the British government, just to suss out what McGuinness's thinking is before Michael Oakley retires, after having worked on this for 20 odd years. Oakley is very impressed with McGuinness, says he's rather like a high-ranking, tough British Army officer like the Paras or the SAS, and gets on with McGuinness. And McGuinness tells Oakley that, Oakley's saying, you've got a choice. Either you can carry on, fighting and killing and losing your own comrades, or you can reach some kind of solution and bring this this to an end. And he says, and you've got to remember that the political framework has changed and is changing, because by then, we, the British, were members of the European Union. And it was partly because of that membership that, again, that helped make Good Friday possible, because that was the sort of umbrella over the agreement and the umbrella over the relationship between Britain and Ireland. And then he reports back to John Chilcot, who was the senior official at the Northern Ireland office, and does a report and debriefs John Chilcot on what McGuinness has said. It's as a result of that, a direct result of that unauthorized conversation with McGuinness, that the British then set up, MI5 sets up Operation Chiffon, whose aim is twofold: to get the IRA to declare a ceasefire, and secondly, to get the IRA, Sinn Féin, to take part in political talks. So that's basically the background. And the latest of MI5, because there were issues between MI6 that had, you know, run these operations for 20 years and MI5, who say, look, Northern Ireland is our responsibility, you know, get your tanks off our lawn. And MI5 takes over. And it's Robert, person I know is Robert, who then takes over Operation Chiffon, which is, you know, the final stage, the critical stage of the story, because it's Chiffon that leads indirectly to the talks that lead to the Good Friday Agreement, or help make Good Friday possible, because the IRA in the end declare the ceasefire, without which there would have been no Good Friday Agreement.
I assume you said that one of the men met with Martin McGuinness and talked with him. I assume that the, would say, like, the official kind of stance from British intelligence and British government would be that we don't negotiate with people we deem to be terrorists. We won't kind of legitimize them by sitting down with them and hearing what they want and kind of negotiating with them. So I assume I assume all these meetings have to be, like, completely off paper.
Absolutely.
Couldn't exist in, you know.
they don't exist, you know. They're deniable. Deniability was the key thing. Because if it came out, remember that throughout all this period, the violence is continuing, not just at the hands of the IRA, but at the hands of the loyalist paramilitaries, the UDA, the UFF, and the UVF. So it has to be kept absolutely dead secret. And it's only when it becomes public knowledge that this has been happening that the proverbial hits the fan and the ceiling falls in, when the public are informed that, despite government denials, the government has been secret IRA on and off for nearly 30 years.
What was there much of a backlash, either like a public backlash or within Parliament or within government, when it came out that that British intelligence had been meeting with a bunch of people who they declared terrorists, you know?
That was expected, because just before Sir Patrick Mayhew, who was the Northern Ireland Secretary, who had to face the music once it became open that these meetings had happened, in particular one meeting that Robert had held unofficially face-to-face with McGuinness, which I'll talk about in a bit later. Patrick Mayhew, the proverbial having hit the fan, has to face the House of Commons and face the accusation that, you know, you, the government, lied to us. John Major lied to us when he said it would turn my stomach to talk to Gerry Adams. So Mayhew has to face the House of Commons and thinks he's going to be eaten alive. And he's very nervous, apprehensive about it. I mean, I talked to Patrick Mayhew about it before he died. But he goes in to the House of Commons and is applauded. He gets a sort of rapturous reception because, at long last, as I say in the book, politicians from all sides are just relieved that at long last it appears that the government are actually doing something to try and end the conflict. So it surprised John Major, it surprised Patrick Mayhew, and it no doubt surprised the members of the House of Commons.
Can you tell me a little bit about maybe the various, I don't know if they were all considered intelligence agencies, but work groups that would do, like, intelligence type work. I mean, I just read when Steak Knife died recently, I read that book, the book Steak Knife, and it was about him and the FRU, which was, like, another kind of semi-police, kind of semi-military unit that would that had, like, spies and moles and intel. And can you tell me a bit about maybe the different groups that were at play? Because there was a few, you know.
Well, Steak Knife was run and recruited by the army, by military intelligence, known as the Force Research Unit, known in shorthand as the FRU. he was an individual who was directed by his military handlers. My understanding is that he was never handled by MI5. He was handled by military intelligence. And what happened is that these different agencies, MI6, latterly MI5, RUC Special Branch, all operated independently. There was no sort of joined up intelligence operation, and they all jealously kept their secrets themselves. If they had an agent like Steak Knife, then they would be very reluctant to share that knowledge of that agent, and certainly the product of what he was saying, with rival. You would have thought they were all fighting the same enemy and therefore worked together, but it wasn't like that at all. There were intense territorial and institutional rivalries between the different elements of British intelligence. So Steak Knife is recruited and works his way up the ranks of the IRA and ultimately reaches a very high level, which to the British and to his military handlers is great news, because he becomes head of the IRA's internal security unit, colloquially known as the Nutting Squad. The Nutting Squad, because that's the nut, and what ended up, that's what marked the end of many of the suspected IRA informants, bullet or bullets in the back of the head, in the nut, hence the Nutting Squad.
Following a vicious session of torture, and usually like a confession, be it forced or not, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I got hold of not just the transcripts of some of these interrogations, but the actual tapes of them. There's no suggestion on the tapes, as you could imagine, of torture, but the evidence afterwards from the postmortems indicated that there were signs of ill treatment and torture. I mean, the IRA complained quite rightly about the way that their volunteers, their comrades, had been ill-treated in Castlereagh, but that was nothing compared to the way that I've known that some of the suspected informants, or touts as they were known, were treated prior to their final demise with a bullet in the back of their head. So because Steak Knife is in charge of this internal security operation, he then knows who the suspected touts or British agents are. He identifies them, and then the interrogations follow. But also he tells, one assumes, his handlers which of their agents are in jeopardy, so they can get their agents, clear out of the way. So Steak Knife trod the narrowest of narrow lines, providing the IRA with intelligence on who the suspected British agents were, and providing his handlers, his British handlers, on who the IRA leaderships were. So it worked both ways, and he was a great asset to British intelligence. The problem is that a lot of what is written about Steak Knife, not all of it, and there was a really good documentary on BBC Northern Ireland a couple of nights ago, which is on iPlayer, about Steak Knife, and it just, and a lot of it is based on speculation, because Steak Knife died two or three weeks ago and took his secrets to the grave with him. But the question over Steak Knife is, how much did his handlers, basically the military, know about those who were going to be executed, murdered by the IRA? And if they knew about them, why didn't they intervene to stop it? That's the question. And so the issue is, what was the involvement What did the British state know about what was happening? What did military intelligence know about the jeopardy that their agents were under, whom Slate Knife would tell them were probably going to be nutted, executed, murdered? That question still has to be answered. And I think, you know, we've got to be careful about making, I mean, one assumes that Slate Knife's handlers would have known who was likely to be arrested by the IRA and interrogated by the IRA. And therefore, you know, why didn't they intervene to save that individual's life? I mean, it was a dreadful conundrum. And, you know, we don't know the truth. We may never know the complete truth about Slate Knife, but the operation to get at the truth that was set up in 2016 under John Boucher, former chief constable of Bedfordshire, with, you know, I think the budget must have been unlimited, effectively, to try and get to the bottom of it. Mr. Boucher has virtually finished his investigation, but nobody knows, apart from Mr. Boucher and his team, exactly what the conclusions of his report is going to be. And I certainly don't know. And it will be, you know, read very closely. And it's very important. It's the most definitive report that's ever been commissioned by any British government looking at collusion. There have been other reports about collusion between loyalist paramilitaries and the British state, but there's been nothing of this intensity, this duration, and this expense.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, they are playing, like Slate Knife's handlers, for example, they're playing a very, very tough kind of, probably like a chess game of sorts, where, like, if you're one of their rats, and if I'm one of their rats, but you're higher up, it's kind of worth it. It might be worth it in one sense for me to get caught, but for you to stay, even if my getting caught would even like boost your position, you know, if it made it look better that Peter caught a rat and it turned out it was John. I think there's definitely accusations that there was like a trading element. They would trade one lesser mole for the ability to keep another one. And the other thing is, like, you might be able to save me another mole, but if they use your information, it might be a little obvious that it came from you. So they're showing their hand. There's a real kind of juggling act going on with that, you know.
I say nobody knows the truth of what Slate Knife actually did. It's all speculation. And I think a lot of that speculation may well be true. But I work on the basis that you can speculate as much as you like, but in the end, you've got to have evidence. You've got to be sure that what you're saying, what you're publishing, is accurate. And if you're not sure, you say so. You know, I would write or broadcast, you know, it would appear that, or the likelihood is that, but we can't be sure, because getting the proof is really difficult. One thing that that my colleagues in BBC North documentary, which I say is a, you know, terrific piece of work, is they got hold of a statement made in the court case over an alleged informer who was rescued by the RUC, well, I assume by the SAS and various other units, before, you know, before he was killed, before he was, quotes, executed. And Slate Knife also gave a statement at the trial in which he describes actually pulling the trigger to kill another suspected informant called Joe Fenton. And that statement from Slate Knife, which my colleagues in Northern Ireland got hold of. State Life says that he actually pulled the trigger and killed Joe Fenton. This was shortly before the other case in which State Life was involved. And his involvement was proven because when forensic searches were done of the house where Sandy Lynch, who was the informant who actually was rescued by the British, was interrogated, they found State Knife's fingerprints in the house. So that was evidence that he had been there. So the fact that State Knife had made this admission in court and the fact that he was there, forensically proven, at the house where Sandy Lynch, the other alleged informant, was rescued and then exfiltrated, got out of the country into a safe house somewhere in the UK or abroad, we simply don't know. That's evidence, that's hard evidence. And coming across that is really difficult. But that was one of the rare occasions when you can actually tie State Knife down to killing somebody because he had admitted it in a court statement. And the fact that, you know, he was there at another interrogation. And these are, you know, are difficult and rare to come by.
No, of course,
we await with interest Mr. Boucher's report.
Right. I was going to say the entire world of intelligence services being against groups like the IRA. It all takes place in the shadows and murky and. I'd imagine that even after as you can do as many investigations and reports as you want, that there's probably only so much that's going to come out. So the majority of it's probably just in the past and kind of not verifiable. I actually on that note, if it is found that for example, State Knife's handlers, if it's found that there was significant wrongdoing, very much illegal, completely unethical. Is there any kind of punishment for them? Like now we'll say the investigation was in 2016. I assumed everyone involved is long retired. Is there any kind of blowback for something like a handler, for example, might have done wrong back in the troubles, you know?
The straight answer is, I don't know. But I can't see any handler facing a court because of what he did. I mean, there's a classic case, the time of John Stalker's investigation into the so-called shoot-to-kill incidents of the early 1980s, in which there was evidence and good evidence to prosecute two MI5 officers for destroying evidence that indicated they were bugging somewhere. I won't go into the details, but there was evidence that they had destroyed vital evidence that would have been used in court, and the evidence would have been used to prosecute two MI5 officers. But the officers were prosecuted because it was decided such a prosecution would not be, quotes, in the national interest. So that's always the... the ultimate defense. The state says it's not in the national interest. In other words, we have a duty to defend those who put their lives at risk to help keep us safe, basically. So if there were to be any prosecutions as a result of State Knife, I can't see them coming before a court because the Official Secrets Act would be invoked. Highly, highly unlikely.
Okay. So, given that Ireland is obviously an island, Northern Ireland is up at the top, and there's a border where we can go into what is officially a different country. You're into the Republic. I know there was definitely times when British intelligence operations and operators crossed the border. They went into somewhere where they don't have a official jurisdiction. Was that something that was ever I don't know, we'll say like strictly enforced among the British intelligence? What was it, like a definite no go? What was it, something you get into trouble for if you took your operation across the border?
Well, you've got to remember, as I'm sure you know, that the border is not indicated by a wall or wire or signpost saying you know, apart from on the main roads that say you're now entering the Republic of Ireland. Apart from that, the border is a line on a map, no more, and it's a very wiggly, sort of drunken line on a map. The SAS was deployed in Northern Ireland in 1986. Sorry, 1976, at the time when I was there, after a series of dreadful sectarian murders following the failure at the end of the ceasefire in 1976. And the SAS were deployed by the Secretary of State, Roy Mason, into South Armagh, which is where, you know, a lot of IRA action was taking place. And because South Armagh, as you know, is right on the border, I don't know if any SAS operators said, excuse me, General, Colonel, Brigadier, can we cross the border in pursuit of these individuals? If that question was ever asked, I'm sure it must have been addressed. And what the answer would be, I can only guess. I think it would be, well, if it's in hot pursuit and you believe that they are, you know, IRA quotes terrorists, unquote, then it is your duty to apprehend them. So I think the thing would have been fudged, frankly. But there was a row when it was discovered that the SAS had actually gone across the border, and I remember kidnapped an IRA fugitive whose name escapes me. I think it was Sean somebody. So yeah, and that caused problems when it became clear that the British were ignoring the border and the territorial integrity of the Dublin government, and the Dublin government created quite a stink over it.
I didn't know that for anyone who isn't Irish, the Irish police are called the Gardaí, Garda Síochána. I wasn't aware up until reading Steak Knife, I think, that the Gardaí kind of had any sort of like kind of intel departments, or you know, some like a kind of a secret service of types that dealt with issues around the troubles. Do you know much about the work that Gardaí might have done? Because I literally didn't even know about it until recently.
The Gardaí's counter-terrorist branch was Irish Special Branch, the Garda Special Branch. And they did what the British Special Branch, the RUC Special Branch, did, which is they collected intelligence, they recruited potential agents, they did exactly what special branches do. But they were not hugely coordinated and well organized. There were increasingly close relations between RUC Special Branch and Garda Síochána Special Branch, especially after there had been IRA assassinations related to the border. For example, when Lord Justice Gibson, who was one of the senior judges in Northern Ireland in the non-jury Diplock courts, was returning from the south, I think he'd been on holiday with his wife, and clearly his movements had been IRA. And when he crossed the border, he and his wife were blown up by a carefully placed car bomb on his route, because it was a regular journey that he made. And the question is, you know, why didn't Garda's Special Branch stop it? Were they appraised that there was any plot to assassinate Lord Justice Gibson? Answer, probably not. And also, IUC Special Branch, you know, would not have known about it. So as a result of incidents like that and others, the relationship between the two governments became closer for security reasons. And also it served the interests of the Irish government to crack down on the IRA, but not, the British complaint was they never cracked down on the IRA, that it was a haven for, you know, for fugitives. And it was, there's no question about it. And when they were arrested in court as fugitives, if they said that the offence committed in the North was a political offence, they did it for political reasons, which of course the IRA said they did, and frankly, you know, they did in the great scheme of things, they were not extradited. So, you know, relationships through much of this period that I'm writing about and I've covered were based on mistrust of the North, of the North, of the South, and of the South, of the North, if you like. Those relationships improved immeasurably as time went on. So by the time you get to the Good Friday Agreement, when the border effectively ceases to exist as a border, I mean, it's still there, but because there's sort of free movement across the border, that was a result of the huge improvement in relationships between the two governments. And also, you know, both governments were part of the European Union. That made a huge, huge difference. So, you know, the relationship between North and South on the political level and the security level is another theme that runs through this period that I chronicle in Chiffon from the 70s, early 70s, way through to Good Friday and to today as well.
I actually, the other day I interviewed the author, Rory Carroll, who just wrote the book that I'm about a third way through, Killing Thatcher. Excellent book for anyone who's interested in Northern Ireland as a subject. Fascinating stuff. Did the IRA's eventual, you could call it like bringing the fight to British shores and doing attacks on England, did that have much of an effect kind of either way on this back channel attempt to bring peace? Did it make it more difficult? Did it kind of increase the urgency for it?
I think it brought home to summits, because the violence just continues. The attack on Mrs. Thatcher and the Brighton bomb at the Tory party conference simply, you know, brought it home as if it needed bringing home, which it really didn't, to the British, that, you know, this was a major problem and something had to be done to bring it to an end. So if anything, the continuing violence, IRA violence, and remember, violence also came from the loyalists. People tend to, you know, forget what the loyalists are doing at the same time. And in the end, they have to be persuaded to end their campaign, which is rather more straightforward, because they always maintained that their violence was the result of IRA violence. If the IRA stop, we'll stop. And that's, in fact, what happened after the IRA ceasefire. So I think the continuing IRA military campaign simply brought home the imperative to the British of finding a way out of the dreadful morass. And also, it's interesting that when I asked Robert, the MI5 officer whom I interviewed, about the Warrington bomb, which is really important in terms of the story I'm telling in Operation Chiffon, I said, but, you know, how do you explain the IRA saying they want peace on the one hand, whilst on the other hand carrying out atrocities like the Warrington bomb, in which two, you know, young boys were killed? And Robert just said, well, that's the way they operate. And that, I think, is a sort of pretty standard response from those on the British side who, you know, who studied the IRA, who studied their campaign and everything else. And if you look at IRA ceasefires over the years, they carry on fighting and killing until the moment when the ceasefire is declared. So that came as no surprise, but that's one of the conundrums. And the answer is very simple. That's the way they operate. But on Rory Carroll's book, Killing Thatcher, which I've got, I just bought, but haven't got around to reading yet. I mean, I covered all that. I did an hour and a half documentary on the Brighton bomb, in which I interviewed everybody, and I also did the first interview with the bomber himself, who features heavily in Rory's
Patrick McGee.
Yeah, Patrick McGee. Yeah. You know, who's a really interesting individual who, in the end, saw the light, and you know, his story. I mean, his story really is ahead of the journey, which is an awful cliche, that the IRA made. He's a microcosm of it, from war. And he maintained, in his eyes and his mind, it's exactly what it was. He was a soldier fighting a political military campaign to get the Brits out of Northern Ireland and trying to kill the minister, which I never had any doubt was a revenge attack for the hunger strike and the death of 10 Republican prisoners. That was something that he regarded as a legitimate action. And then, in the end, after he's spent time in, actually a good many years in the maze, he's released under the Good Friday Agreement, crucial part of which, thanks to Tony Blair, was the release of prisoners, which the British denied was an amnesty, but it was everything but an amnesty in name. So I interviewed McGee at length, and then he saw the light, decided that violence was not the answer. It had to be about reconciliation, and that reconciliation is part of peace, that we have a kind of peace in Northern Ireland, which is hugely well, but we don't have a lot of reconciliation. And what Patrick McGee was doing in his own small but important way with the daughter of Sir Anthony Berry, who was a victim, who was killed in the Brighton bomb, who was an MP, and I interviewed his widow as well. But in the eyes of McGee, was a legitimate target. And then he started working for peace and reconciliation, amazingly, with Jo Berry, Sir Anthony Berry's a daughter. So, I mean, I'm very familiar with that, and I'm sure a lot of that will be reflected in Orwell's Killing Thatcher book. But Killing Thatcher is very different from Operation Chiffon. In a sense, they're both, companion books.
Right, yeah. No, I was going to say One is about a more specific incident, and the other being a lot more broad. Speaking of books you've written, I saw that you have a book, I believe it's called Talking with Terrorists, and it's you speak with IRA members, Al Qaeda, etc. I suppose on that note, it can be a tricky question, but what is a terrorist? How is it different from someone who's, dichotomy is usually a terrorist or freedom fighter. But yeah, for you, where's the line between like a terrorist and someone who, someone who's just fighting for the freedom of their country as they see it?
It's in the eyes of the beholder. You know, it's an entirely subjective description. The cliche, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, and vice versa. But it's a phenomenon which isn't unique to our generation. When you look at the history of Rhodesia that becomes Zimbabwe, when you look at Robert Mugabe, who becomes, you know, he was the terrorist in Rhodesia. When you look at the history of the State of Israel, that, you know, the Israeli, quotes, terrorists to us, freedom fighters to the Israelis, terrorists to the Palestinians. It's an entirely subjective term, but it's what is in the head of those who are accused of being terrorists that really matters. If you believe that what you're doing is justified, and I think this is one of the things I wrote about in Beating the Terrorists, if you believe that what you're doing is legitimate and right, the cause is right, Nelson Mandela. You know, there's a whole list of former, quotes, terrorists who become peacemakers. And Martin McGuinness was, you know, quotes, these aren't my words, you know, arch terrorist, public enemy number one, because of his past. But he remarkably was instrumental, along with Gerry Adams, in convincing the IRA that the only way forward to achieve their goal, its goal of United Ireland, was to give up the armed struggle and concentrate politically, which is why the rise of Sinn Féin is so important and effectively generated by the hunger strike and Bobby Sands's election to Westminster. And so, you know, when you look at some of the individuals who've been involved in politics in Northern Ireland, I mean, who've been members of the Northern Ireland Assembly and ministers, you know, people like Gerry Kelly, they were regarded as terrorists. And then they became, you know, individuals running government departments. So they were terrorist, quotes, then because of what they were doing, but they were no longer terrorists because they embraced politics. So, you know, it's a legitimate question to which there is no simple answer. It's subjective and it's in the eyes of the beholder and in the minds of the beholden, if you like.
Interesting. The definition that Google will give, I'm reading it now, is a person who uses unlawful violence and intimidation, especially against civilians, in the pursuit of political aims. That for me would be, yeah, that's sort of how I would look at it. Like in my opinion, like the IRA members who do car bombs and kill innocent people and so on, they are terrorists, but the ones to my view who would just target like military, political, intelligence members, I wouldn't put them in the same category as those who blow up a car bomb in a civilian area and so on. It's funny, I spoke to, I don't know if you read the book, there's a book called The Yank, written by an ex-IRA man called John Crawley, who moved to Ireland when he was like in his teens. He became a Marine and then the IRA, and I asked him the same question, and he said to me that there's no definition of terrorism that you couldn't apply to like a lot of the members of the British intelligence and British Army and so on. You know, they were using violence against, or at least facilitating violence against innocent people in the pursuit of a political aim. Does that definition kind of, does that do anything for you?
The key element in trying to determine, you know, what is a terrorist and what is a freedom fighter is the legislation. The legislation says terrorism is using violence to achieve a political end. And in each of these cases that I've studied, although the ends are very different, I mean, the goal of Al-Qaeda and ISIS that I've looked at also in considerable detail is very different from the rather simple goal of wanting a united Ireland, or as far as the loyalist paramilitaries were concerned, maintaining the relationship with there is behind all, quotes, terrorism, a political motivation. Now, the question is that justified? Well, if you're a person who is regarded as a terrorist, regards it as being justified to commit these, you know, these killings and these attacks to bring the ultimate goal of a united Ireland closer, then it, you know, it takes some persuading of him or her to change their mind. And again, coming back to Operation Chiffon, that traces how and why that transformation within the IRA mindset, and in particular the mindset of the leadership, notably Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, which is then put, you know, passed down to the rank and file and the local IRA commanders north and south of the border. But it's, so it's the political motivation which is the key thing. Now, arguably, unarguably, nothing justifies planting car bombs in Belfast like the IRA did in after Bloody Sunday in 1972. And it's difficult to describe that in terms other than a terrorist act. You're right in making the distinction between targeting innocent civilians, which I've been criticized for saying, you know, was not official IRA policy because it didn't really make sense. But it happened. And therefore, you know, yes, deliberately were innocent civilians targeted and killed. But by and large, and there are notable exceptions, as I have repeatedly stated, the aim was to target military and establishment figures, members of government, you know, anything that represented the British establishment, political and military, would be regarded by the IRA as, quote, legitimate targets, even down to, you know, work who were repairing IUC stations that the IRA had bombed were deemed to be political targets because they were mending the damage done by the IRA to British bases, you know. So it was, extended almost duplicitous way to extend the category of legitimate targets. And it's a very uncomfortable, I mean, killing people in the way that the IRA and other such organizations have done is, you know, is awful. You know, it sort of turns my blood cold in many cases, but it happens. And I've always tried in my work over 50 odd years is to try and understand why that happens. And once you understand why it happens, then you can begin to come to terms with what you have to do to bring it to an end, which again brings us back to Operation Chiffon and the Good Friday Agreement.
On that note, you said you've been covering the Troubles, I mean, almost since they began. What for you kind of drew you to it, and maybe continued to keep you on that subject for a number of decades? I mean, you've written a lot of books about it, TV documentaries, and so on. I mean, it must be something that I don't know, not to say close, but it must hold some importance to you, given you've covered your whole career on it.
Well, I've always maintained since I first started covering Northern Ireland after Bloody Sunday, which was my introduction. I was there, but after on Bloody Sunday, but after the killings and the shootings had happened, and I remember feeling guilty on and in the hours after Bloody Sunday, and the days after, when I, you know, stayed in Derry and did some interviews. I felt guilty that, you know, my soldiers, me being a Brit, and the parachute regiment being the parachute regiment, or one battalion of it, appeared to have shot dead in cold blood 13 innocent civilians. I couldn't understand how and why that happened. If what I was being told by people who were on the march in the bogside, who I was interviewing, you know, hours after the dreadful events of that day, and I felt guilty that I, as a young journalist who'd never been to Ireland before, was ignorant about the history. You know, how had this happened? Why had this happened? What lay at the bottom of it? And that, so I felt guilty on those two counts. And I thought I'd better try and find out. So I spent the next 50 years trying to find out. And I've also, you know, all throughout that time, I maintained that the unresolved Irish question, and it still remains finally unresolved, and was, you know, one of the most important political questions that the British government and the British people faced over 50 years. It was hugely, hugely important. And what I always tried to do was to try and piece the conflict together to try and understand, you know, where it came from. In partition in 1921, 101 years ago, was never intended to be a permanent solution to the Irish question. In the end, it was always intended that there would be Irish unity of some kind with the two parliaments coming together. And that's something I simply did not know, did not understand. So it's, and I became fascinated by it, and I made lots of acquaintances on all sides, on every conceivable side. I got to know people, and I was able to gain their trust, and they trusted me, which has enabled me to do what I've been able to do. I would not have got the interview with Robert that you saw, which enabled me to write the book Operation Chiffon, without what I'd done before. He'd seen my documentaries and thought that he felt he wanted his story to be told, and I was the person to tell it, which was, you know, very flattering, but it was based on what I'd done before and what he'd seen, considering that when I first met him, he denied he was who he was.
I see. I'll let you go there. I appreciate you. I appreciate you joining me. Fascinating subject. I look forward to getting the book myself. I'll put links in the description. To for everyone to be able to go get the book.
Okay. Thanks again.
Thank you very much, Peter. Take care, mate.